Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SFB Online, Fed Come Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have talk guests every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk Show website at www.talkshow.com. And search for Callie 17702. Or you can join us on Twitch. We do a co-broadcast on Twitch, so you can find it there. Just go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall, and you will find it right there. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to, you can reach me via Twitter. My podcast account is SFU On Call. Got a personal account called Paul Franz, P-A-U-F-R-A-N-Z. If you're interested in that one, just a reminder that I am very proud of being a Catholic, an O's fan, and I love tech. So if any of those bothers you, don't follow me. And of course, I have my Franz Games account, which I use for business purposes, i.e. Announcements when it comes to Starfleet Warlord, announcements when it comes to client updates and SFB Online, and everything when it comes to those things. And just before I forget, because Lord knows I tend to forget, this reminder, this will be the last podcast for the year due to Christmas and New Year's happening on a Friday. It's kind of, my wife would not appreciate me doing podcasts on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. So it's like, I am going to push everything off until next year. So if I cannot, just so I don't forget, I wish everyone a happy holidays, a Merry Christmas. Well, as I say, happy Hanukkah, but by the time you listen to this, Hanukkah is going to be over. And Happy New Year's. Moving onward and forward, not much happening at ADB lately, because Lord knows it's end of year, so things tend to slow down just a hair. But when it comes to the SFB Online tournament, the Sapphire Crown 2020 tournament, the final, which is going to be Jack Taylor versus Peter Bakia, Mad Jack versus Bakia is the call signs. That will be played on Sunday the 20th. That's this weekend. If you're listening to this before Sunday the 20th, December 20th, and that will be starting at 3 p.m. Eastern time. At least that's what it is currently scheduled for. If I was you, I'd show up just a few minutes early just in case the opponents do get there early and decide they're going to start anyway, because it's not like there's a set schedule for this kind of stuff. And we're moving on to the FedCom library. Not much happening there. I've not got any response from Chris. I will have to ping him to see how he's going. And, you know, so squadron size is still 6,377, fleet size is 278. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight we have Barry, and that's about it. So, how you doing, Barry?
Hey there. I'm doing wonderful.
Awesome.
How about you?
I'm doing good. All ready for Christmas?
Yeah, I guess so. It's going to be weird this year.
Understood.
I guess everybody could say the same thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure what your normal thing is when it comes to Christmas, whether you have a large family gathering or what, you know. Obviously, since my son Tad, he is in a group home, and there's no visits, so he will not be joining us for Christmas this year. because of the whole, COVID thing. The numbers being too high, and they can't risk, someone in the family having COVID and then bring it back with them,
So. Mm-hmm.
It's understandable.
Well, there is a vaccine out. There's a couple of vaccines.
Yep. Well, normal people probably, the way I guess it, is normal people will start seeing it around April. Because, obviously we're not top priority. People who are front lines, the doctors, the nurses, people like that. And then, of course, the people who are most at risk of, dying. From those are the people that are front of the line, basically. So that's why I figured we won't be seeing it for a while. But so we still have to keep on our guard,
Now?
Oh, what was that?
Still there?
Hold on. Yeah, I'm still here.
Heard you for a second.
Yeah, I know. Why not? Give me a sec, because.
Oh, okay.
I need to do one thing, which is.
Yeah, you went away for a little while.
Yep. Somebody. Oh, freaking posers. Okay. So I think I'm just going to do that instead. Thank you very much. Actually, the fortunate thing is that I am not sharing my screen at the moment. So somebody was being a moron.
Okay.
So, anyhow.
Anyhow. So, yeah. So, you enjoying the snow?
Enjoying is a relative term. because of, I had to go out there and shovel all the snow. I think we got like 12 inches around here.
Well, silly me, I didn't check the weather forecast, and I don't watch regular TV. So, apparently the local city of York decides to announce snow emergencies on the local news station. Which I don't get because I don't have TV.
Understood, but the question is, dear friend, how else are they supposed to do it?
Well, they could have posted signs on the street, But any case, the first notice that they had decided that it was a snow emergency was I looked outside and my car was gone.
Yeah, because it's no emergency, therefore the streets have to be clear. Yeah.
And my first warning or notice was, hey, your car's been towed.
Cool.
It was about a 5-6 mile walk to get. Well, I didn't have a car to drive over there anymore, so I had to walk 5-6 miles to pick it up.
Right.
And then they had insult injury. They wanted $225 plus there was a parking ticket.
So the 200 some bucks is, I assume, was like for a towing fee kind of thing, and then you got a ticket because you're parking basically in a no parking zone at that point, kind of thing.
Right, and it was literally there was like I didn't even know the snow was coming. I mean, I saw it's like a dusting. It's like, what the heck? Yeah.
Dude, it's...
Yeah, they were a little aggressive late, but it about is winter. That one.
So you,
yeah.
Even I look out at the weather, at least on my app, I see what the week ahead is showing. At least I do that. Even though I don't look at the local news, but
Yeah, well, that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, it was my exercise for yesterday.
I agree that that's definitely an exercise.
Yeah. Yeah, they should have given a little bit more notice. They were gonna do that. Oh well. Yeah, I got. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm showing people on the video cast a real quick thing, which is proposal for January, which is basically they're planning on doing for Shapeways on captor mines, or I'm assuming not just captor mines, but different kinds of mines. You know, which is something
Okay.
that they now can do. And the one thing that Steve Cole posted was that they're showing a small and large captor mine, you know, the drone captor mines. And Steve Cole said, I want a 24
Yeah.
inch bronze version from the roof of my car. So it looks like mini missiles on top of his car. Like he could fire at people. I thought that was kind of funny, and I had to show it to people.
Yeah.
But anyhow, yeah,
A
the
drone mine, eh?
yeah. Hey, why not? I'm assuming they're gonna have different kind of mines. You've got your photon captor, you've got your phaser captor, you know, you got there's different kind of captor mines that are actually available. I'm not sure how much difference, you know, they're gonna be able to do. You know, I'm assuming they'll have something different between like a photon and a phaser. You know, a photon weapon mount looks definitely different than a phaser one, which is more of a pip than anything else. And things like
Well, to
that.
tell you the truth, most the explosive mine makes sense. The drone mine makes sense. Phaser mine, no. And here's the reason why. Any mine that requires a lot of power is going to have a power generation. It's not going to be hidden. Anything has enough power generation capability is how do you know? Okay, photon torpedo takes 1 point of power per turn just to hold it. It's going to sit there for years on end waiting while expending 1 point of power per turn. No. That would be unbelievably expensive, and it would be radiating heat like crazy. You could detect it from across the board.
Bring up on my
But
computers. I could sworn there are all kinds of captor mines.
yeah.
Hey, no falling
When
asleep
did
on
the
me, dude.
photon mine work?
What's that?
What's that?
You
The
said
only way to make a
something?
photon mine would be to give it so that it turns on, you can detect it, and it takes two turns to arm. Course, that wouldn't be too useful, would it?
Nope. I'm pretty sure they have like plasma captor mines. I'm looking.
Well, a plasma F maybe is its stasis field.
Right.
But even then, that's freaking expensive. It would be freaking expensive.
Oh, those were okay. That's interesting.
What?
Wow. That is cool. Okay.
What?
Rule M11. Transcaptor mine. The Andromedans operate a unique type of mine known as a transcaptor, short for transporter captor mine. The transcaptor mine contain 4 T-bombs, or PA mines, and a transporter able to deploy them. The transcaptor mine was used as active defense system around Andromeda bases. These mines were found around the first Andromeda base encountered in Y-171. Oh, well,
so you're sitting there, and all of a sudden the transport's mines all around you.
Yep.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. It's like, wow, that's a cool one. Because definitely,
yeah.
Can you imagine a base having transcaptor mines, where,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, a ship coming in or drones coming in, because these are remotely controlled because they're captor mines, you know. Say, okay, you know. I just want to look at that for a moment. Base must have active fire control. Big surprise. And right, I just want to double check on one thing. Operation when commanded to do so. The base control. Captain mine has a built-in. Decay by its nature. The transcaptor is undetectable. Transcaptor mine can place one T-bomb or one PM mine each turn, but not within 8 impulses, so you can place one per captor mine.
Yeah. Now, here's one. It reminded me of something. I've been rereading the Honor Harrington series. I don't know if you have...
I never read it.
Talk to you about that series?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You've talked
never
to me about it. I just never read it myself.
Yeah. And those ships are really interesting. And yes, they're starships. Yes, they have, but the Honorverse, you have hyperspace. But basically, it's what hyperspace is it basically when you're in hyperspace, everything in the universe is closer together. So you travel at sublight speeds in hyperspace,
mm-hmm.
but if the universe has shrunk, then you're effectively going FTL.
Wow. Hmm? Oh, by the way,
and
I just looked up the captor mines. There are a few of them. One has 6 Type 1 drones, 1 3 Plasma Fs, 1 3 Disruptors, 1 has 3 Phaser 2s, another has 2 Hellbores, another one has 2 Photons, another one has 6 Plasma Ds, another one has 12 dogfight drones. The other one has 12 anti-drones. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So
those are large ones anyway. They have smaller versions, which have, you know, yeah, lower number of armament. But anyway, moving back to Harrington.
Going back to the Honorverse. Yeah, so the ships are basically sublight, and they use a gravity drive, and so you're talking about acceleration, and they can do, you know, several hundred gravities of acceleration. So, but it might take hours to get into range of your opponent,
right?
Or and so basically the way the gravity drive works, it's called an impeller drive, is you have a gravity band above the ship and a gravity band below the ship, which are, those gravity bands are completely impenetrable to any known weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you try to hit the ship from above or below, it just bounces. And on the sides between, so you basically have 2 inclined planes forming a wedge,
right,
above and below the ship, and the ship's kind of between these 2 planes. So you'd have to come around to the side of the ship to actually hit it. And they take the top band and the bottom band, and they put a sidewall between them. And the sidewall is not impenetrable, but it does act as a fairly good shield.
Mm-hmm.
But the front and the aft there is no sidewall. You can't put a sidewall there. Otherwise, the ship loses all maneuverability. So, yeah, if you hit a ship from in front or from behind, it's like wide open. It has basically no shields.
Right.
In the Honorverse, I guess missile weapons. Typically, missiles might have 50,000 gravities of acceleration, but they burn out after a couple of minutes.
Right.
But the thing is that if the missile, trying to get a missile to go between the two bands, the gravity bands on the belly or the dorsal, but you want to slip it between on the side, it needs to come in from just the right vector, and of course the ship could rotate. And
right.
So hitting the ship with a nuclear bomb, it's kind of like you'd have to have the missile as it goes past the ship detonate. And then they had standoff missiles with X-ray lasers powered by fusion bombs. So you basically detonate the bomb, and that would power the X-ray lasers. Obviously, that destroys the X-ray lasers. But so as the missile goes past the ship and it finds the sidewall or the front or the back, and detonates, hopefully in one of those locations.
Right, but it's a ranged weapon, basically.
It's a ranged weapon.
Yeah.
And then they had energy weapons, which were basically lasers or grazers that would fire out the sidewall. So a lot of broadside armaments. But typically, the heaviest ship in that universe or ship of the wall, so to speak, would be, instead of ship of the line, it's ship of the wall, because everything's 3D in that universe, would be something like a super dreadnought, which is about 8 million tons. Pretty massive, much bigger than a B-10. You could have fleets of these ships, but a super dreadnought might be able to fire 20 missiles in a salvo, in a broadside. And so, but later on in the universe, they came up with what's known as, somebody said, hey, we can create a pod, and this reminds me of your transporter captor mine. Reminded me of this, where they basically have pods that were towed by tractors, and the pods were very soft targets because they did not have sidewalls or impeller bands to protect them. So if you detonated a nuke anywhere near the pod, you would take it out.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing the pods had going for them was that if you saw missiles coming at your ship and you were towing pods, you could drop the pods before the missiles got close. You'd be accelerating, and if the missiles didn't see the pods, the other thing was that a pod would hold about 6 to 10 missiles per pod. So even a dreadnought, a super dreadnought might have a broadside of 20 missiles, but a destroyer could carry could tow a pod on tractors, and or a light cruiser might carry two or three pods on tractors. So that could you could for one salvo at least. A destroyer or a cruiser could pack more punch than a super dreadnought. But then later on in as technology advanced, somebody said, well, let's create a device, a ship called a podnaut, which instead of having broadside armament, it's just basically a ship that's filled with pods and it just drops them out the back. So it could drop hundreds of pods, and all of a sudden you had fleets of ships firing tens of thousands of missiles at each other.
While facing away from each other.
What's that?
While facing away from each other. Because they're coming out the rear.
Well, yeah, well, yeah, they would just, the ship's accelerating, the pods get dropped out behind it, and then they say, okay, fire. And, you know, 30 pods go all at once. And
right.
It's like, okay, that was 300 missiles. And, yeah, you know, it's like, holy crap, how do you stop that?
You don't.
Okay, most of them are.
You die.
You're not going to get them all. You're not going to get them all.
Understood. Understood.
Yeah, then Manticore, which was the most technologically advanced ones out there, and they came out with those, and then they came out with extremely long range missiles that were extremely accurate. Drives, as I said, could go for 2 minutes at 50,000 G's of acceleration, then they'd burn out. And Manticorans developed multi-stage missiles, which had up to three drives that could fire in sequence, or fire one, wait, fire another, wait. So now you could get incredibly long ranges on the missiles. And there was one battle with the Solarian League, which was basically Earth, you know, Sol, and they were like the big bad empire and galaxy, and they figured, okay, well, we're going to go up against the Manticorans. Oh, well, we've got, you know, 30 dreadnoughts. Oh, what have they got? Oh, they've got a couple of battle cruisers over there. Yeah, well, battle cruiser versus something that's 10 times the size of a B-10 doesn't stand a chance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but those battle cruisers were armed with, were basically pod-not battle cruisers. Took out the super dreadnoughts so far beyond the super dreadnoughts range, missile range. It was like, what?
Understood.
Because Larians got their asses handed to them.
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
Yeah. Different universe, different rules.
Oh, agreed. Totally different universe.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Any case. So last week, I think we discussed second-generation X-ships.
Yes, we did. And Lord knows I got quite a few comments on that.
Oh, what did they say?
Some of them were basically complaining that Steve Cole, you know, put out the second-generation X-ships and never improved them, never fixed the rules, never fixed the ships. You know, and
I agree completely.
Oh, understood. But in my mind, it takes a brave person to put out a product, say, you know, we should never put out that product. It was broken. We're not going to try just to patch it up, you know. We're gonna rethink it and redo it and do it right, which is what I think Steve Cole wants to do now. You know,
good. It took him too long, but
right. Oh, understood.
He should have done that 20 years ago.
Oh, understood. But at the same time, well, I would never say 20 years ago, because the issue with 20 years ago was Task Force Games was still running the show. So
it was,
you know,
80 meets in 2000.
Yeah,
that might be 30 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. True. But supplement number two was released, and also, second generation X-ships. So that's not really a top priority here. compared to other products that would actually.
No, it's never been a top priority.
And here's the gotcha on it. That these people were expecting a fix to the rules that was a free addendum. So they wanted Steve Cole to fix it, and they wanted to do it for free. Wanted to do all the hard
work.
Well,
that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have no problem paying for it if he fixes it.
Right. Understood. I agree, that he delayed things a bit. I will agree there. But at the same time, yes.
Yeah, people just kept saying, well, we're going to improve things in the general war era. We're going to improve things in the general war era. But, that's only a period of 5-10 years. So it's like, okay. But, it's been, when did general war era, you saw things like battle cruisers come out. To replace heavy cruisers went to battle cruisers. And the way ships got better was they got bigger and they put more systems on them.
Yeah.
So you saw a lot of that, but you went for, like your Klingons, you went for your B refits and your K refits. And, did they go any further than that? I guess D7C and, what was the next one after that? D7L or something like that?
Yep, D7L.
Yeah. Or D7W, I think, was okay.
But that was kind of... D7W was supposed to be like a war cruiser kind of D7, if I recall correctly. It's been a while.
No, it was a hopped-up D7C. It was... The W was, the D7W, I think, was like the wing phasers. Instead of having one on the left and one on the right, they had two on the left and two on the right. And I think they may have got, it was less powerful than the C7
right.
battle cruiser.
Right.
It was somewhere between a D7K. And which was the D7C with all the K refits, but it was the D7W was between a D7K and a C7.
Right. This is okay. Here's the description of the ship.
The difference there.
The Corelli Design Bureau, exploring further enhancements in the venerable D7 hull, incorporates several innovative design features into the D7W. This was the most powerful D7 variant ever built. Barring the DX, the ship had take more copious shuttle bays, extra wing phasers when compared to the D7C. UAM, there's one UAM module standard equipment, backups are available. The original design, which was considerably more powerful, was done by Steve Cole. After play testing revealed it was too powerful, the design was revised by Cole and Petrick.
Yeah.
And it was in module R5.
So. Yeah, I remember buying module R5. It had the D7W, and it's like, okay. And that may have been after they, I guess, nerfed it a little bit. And it may be that the one that they originally designed that was too powerful may have ended up as a C7 or something close to it.
That wouldn't surprise me because D7, it's defined as a heavy command cruiser. So... that's one of those things that drives me crazy, which is designators.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Chris, I forget his last name, and he's doing some FedCom ship cards for the client. And
yeah,
the Federation, the heavy battle crew, the heavy command cruiser is a CB, not a CCH. CB. It's like, what the heck?
Okay.
For like the Zinni or the Gorn, CCH is a heavy command cruiser. And to me, that makes...
Yeah.
CCH for heavy command cruiser makes absolute sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
But CB, okay.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, agreed.
But in any case, so they came out with the, I guess the DXs, the first generation X ships. And there it was kind of like, well, instead of putting more systems in, we're going to just put better systems in there. Because other than, you know, the general war, yeah, like I guess the major improvements were going from Phaser 2s to Phaser 1s for the Klingons, and going from A-racks to B-racks and maybe better drone types available. Beds, they really only added G-racks. That was more adding systems than improving systems.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas DX or the first generation X ships, it was a matter of, okay, we're actually going to put better systems in there. And it could be argued that, you know, they had more power, more warp power with the same movement cost. So that would be more efficient warp engines, which, okay, that's an improved system.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I know the second generation X ships that we looked at, I think they typically had, we didn't discuss it last week, but like the Fed heavy cruiser, and I think they pretty much all did 40 warp.
Yeah.
On a movement cost one ship.
Oh, yeah. It was, well, as we noted last week, Barry, the whole second generation X ships were just so unbalanced. It was crazy.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah. Well, the problem was that the improvements to the various weapon systems were not done evenly.
Right. Agreed.
You know, and like, for example, some of the ships, well, we're going to give you better systems, and then we're going to give you more, whereas the Fed, it was kind of like, eh, we're just going to give you better systems, but not much better. Although... Photons were a heck of a lot better because the range and the hit numbers for the overloads were, but the,
oh,
as
yeah,
good as they made them, they made the disruptors even better.
Yeah, but that was the biggest issue that we saw, which was, okay, they improved the Fed's photons, okay, cool, but then they really improved the Klingon disruptors to the point where it's like, this is nuts. You know?
Yeah.
I can
almost like third. The disruptors were almost like third generation.
Right. It's like, okay, wait a minute. I'm sorry. If you wanted to make them second generation, make them improved, yeah, you could do the whole double overloads and that kind of thing. Fine. But capacitors? Really?
Don't add. No, no.
Yeah.
Now, no. What they could have done is the double overload could have, without the capacitor, but they could have made the double overload a little cheaper to arm, 6 power instead of 4.
Right.
And what they could have also done is it only has 4 disruptors, just like the Fed only has 4 photons. Well, you only give it 4 disruptors. Now, without capacitors, 6 points of power is, yeah, it's more efficient, which is in keeping with, but it, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, because at that point, the Fed does have the advantage that it can hold its overloads.
Right.
Whereas the Klingon cannot.
Right.
So therefore, cheap, yeah. So that would have worked. But then in the drones, of course, they just went nuts with them.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. You know, yeah, it definitely needs to be more thought through. I agree. And the biggest issue for ADB actually fixing them, you know, earlier on is this was not top priority, which is understandable. The question is, because, come on, most of the players are interested in General War, period. They're not interested in Omega.
Right.
They're not interested in the Triangulum Galaxy. They're not interested in LMC. They're not interested in anything outside the General War. You know?
Yeah.
So second generation X ships weren't really going to sell that well. You know?
Well, if they would have sold better if they had balanced the product properly.
Yeah, but compared to copies of R10 or R11, and I don't remember what those are.
What was R10? Ships were.
I don't know. I don't remember. But you know, the SSD books, you know.
Yeah.
You know, those sold, and it didn't require new rules, didn't require, you know, it required thinking about the design and how those designs would express themselves, but it was easier, and you keep the business running, basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, I understand it. You know, obviously, hopefully, that in the next year or two, those things will be resolved. Because I know there has been interest,
right.
You know, as I mentioned earlier this month or last month, that ADB is, you know, people are expressing interest that they want second generation X ships, and Steve Cole is open to certain ideas that people have been bringing forward. So
now, if you really want to do it right, you need to create tournament second generation X ships. That way you can balance them.
Right, understood. Well, the big issue there, obviously, is in what environment. Because, see, the big thing with tournament ships is they're balanced, well, relatively. They're not really 50-50 for all the ships combination, and you'll agree there. Everyone will agree there. The fishbowl.
Yeah.
They're tweaked to fly in the fishbowl. While second generation X ships, when they're actually played in a real scenario, it won't be in a fishbowl.
Don't play so well.
So
no, they actually try to fight at longer ranges.
Yeah, and more importantly, yeah, they might be fighting. These are trade wars. So in my mind, it's a rare thing that they'd ever have an open space battle. It's mostly around the planet or something along those lines, because the whole idea of the trade wars themselves was that you don't have these large fleets. You have possibly, every once in a while, you might have a squadron. But more, it's single-ship battles, single-ship combat. And usually, because it's trade wars, it's about, you know, either logistics or, the most, you know, rudimentary ones, which is planets themselves. And they might be fighting over, over planets.
Right.
The whole idea of the trade wars is, you know, less violence. And we can't afford to put all this money into building these ships, basically.
Yeah. In the Honorverse, for example, it would be extraordinarily rare for ships to actually fight in hyperspace. And typically, it would be extremely rare for a ship to fight outside of a star system.
Right.
And the way that was done was he basically said that every star created what was known as a hyperlimit. And if you were within a certain range of a star, and the bigger the star, the bigger the hyperlimit, then most of the habitable planets of that star would be inside of the hyperlimit. So for Sol, the hyperlimit would be 22 light minutes, which is out past the orbit of Mars. So if you wanted to get to Earth, you'd have to spend quite a bit of time inside the hyperlimit. And if you're inside the hyperlimit, you can't go into hyper.
Right.
Because, for example, if you're firing missiles at somebody outside the hyperlimit, it might take them a minute or two for the of warning from to transition, but if they have enough time, if you fire the missiles from far enough away, they can say, "Oh, I'm ducking into hyperspace," and poof, missiles can't follow me into hyperspace.
Understood. I agree. It'd be nice, basically, to have tournament ships, kind of, some playtest ships that can be put that ADB will allow to be put in the online client, so that people can play them, virtually. Which I think I'm hoping, Steve Cole will do something like that, because Lord knows, if they will allow some playtest ships, give us some. Some ships that we play test, and I can because I actually I did that for the LMC, yeah, the LMC, yeah, I did that for Ken Burnside, so that he could get some people to play
Yeah,
test on the SLB Online. If Steve Cole would do the same thing, we could get quite a bit more play tests, and Lord knows, that would also increase, I think that would really help to increase the people using SLB Online. It would encourage people to join the SLB Online. Just for those people who played SLB for a long time and they want to play test the new ships. Obviously, when they actually
Yeah, the
get.
fishbowl for the tournament is different because typically, you're going to be, okay, we have a battle, and okay, so somebody, you're not, deep space duels are going to be the exception to the rule
Right.
because it's like, oh, they're more powerful than me. I run away if I can,
Right.
or I'm more powerful than them. They're going to try to run away. So the only thing that can force it. Ships to stand and fight is if they have something that they need to protect,
Right. Well,
wild or something
that's
like
true
that.
for normal battles as it stands. Usually you don't have an open map battle because the only time you have an open map battle is usually because it's a delaying tactic because you're trying to delay that fleet that's coming in so that you can basically evacuate the planet that's behind you. Give people opportunity to do that or you're trying to disrupt logistics, the logistics network, where you're away from any population nodes.
Well, if you look at standard naval battles, it was I don't think it was that common for entire navies to slug it out. The Battle of Jutland comes to mind as one of those rare instances where two relatively balanced fleets tried to duel it out. Of course, the Brits did much better. Came out of that one ahead of the game. That one. I don't know if you're familiar with the Battle of Jutland.
No, I'm not.
World War One era battleships. I think it was the Brits versus the Germans in the North Sea or something like that. And the two fleets basically in the two fleets basically squared off, and the Brits got the better end, did better than the Germans. And I think there was some limited visibility involved. So, and I think one of the things that the Brits managed to pull off was a tactic known as crossing the T, where you had a whole bunch of battleships in a line. And they went right in front of the German line and crossed their T, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And now you had broadsides firing up raking shots where the German ships could not bring their broadsides to bear. They were pumping out less shells.
Right.
And getting hit from that angle, the armor is not as effective. Now, sure, it's a lot harder to hit a ship dead on like that, but when you do, it's much more devastating.
Right.
And you're more likely to have a shot actually hit the deck and go, and there's very little armor on the deck.
That is true.
Whereas if you, yeah. So, yeah, crossing somebody's T is a very devastating attack. And I think because of limited visibility, the Brits are actually able to cross the T on Germans twice in the Battle of Jutland. Jellicoe was the name of the admiral, and the mm-hmm. British admiral. And due to politics after the battle, he was relieved of command. He got like one of the great victories in naval history, and then he was didn't treat him too well.
Right, right.
But other than that, another example of an open battle would have been Midway, which I guarantee you're familiar with that one.
Oh, yeah.
But that was more a matter of the aircraft had very long ranges, and so it was a matter of launching attacks from out of sight, and you kind of said, well, we think the enemy is in that direction. Launch fighters, and you go run into them. But that would have been like what would be the way of describing Midway.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting handguns at each other in a darkened room where you can't see. That's pretty much what it would have amounted to, you know?
Yeah, understood.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. That's one of the things I wanted to discuss tonight, which was actually the idea of what is needed to bring more people into SFB. Because one thing that my daughter's taught me is that even new, relatively young kids, quote unquote kids. My daughter's 25 years old. Sorry, 23.
Understood.
I have one that's 25 and one that's 23. And the one I was talking to is the one that's 23 and loves board games. I've said many times on that, which is, she's the one who brings me hope that board games are not dead. Playing physical board games is not dead. Now, the big question for me when it comes to SFB Online and FedCom and all that is, are these kind of games less likely to be played actually physically on a table? You know?
It's been over 2 to 3 years since I last played Starfleet Battles on a table. I think the last time I played it was against you.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the because the only reason I say that for SFB and FedCom at all is that the big issue there in my mind when it comes to physical board games is that a lot of that stuff, all the moving around the counters and that kind of thing, in my mind, you know, can easily be done on the screen. Now, given that, things like the Star Armada or ACTA, ACTA SF, I forget what that stands for.
Mm-hmm.
Which are basically the design, the rules that are simplified Starfleet battles, simplified mainly for the use with miniatures.
Right.
That, when you've got the physical models, car arms. Thank you so much. I call it arms. That's what ACTA is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that game engine is designed for miniatures.
For miniatures. Yeah.
So that I can see people still bringing out the miniatures and flying those things around because you have that the physical it gives you the better 3D effect than playing with counters. Obviously, if you can get the 3D ships on screen, then that goes up, goes the way too. But of course, then you don't have the whole Warhammer 4K effect. I think it's a 4K or 2K. Where the well the
4K.
The, okay, 4K. I thought it was 4K. And that is.
It was.
Yeah, that is having the pride of painting your miniatures and then using them to fight against your friends. You know?
Yeah.
Which is, can be a heck of a lot more, you know, fun of, you know, as I said, having that pride of painting up your own miniatures.
Yeah.
And because you, one great thing about that is you can customize those miniatures to look how whatever you way they want, whether it's the colors, decals, however far you want to take it, you can take it.
Yeah.
Huh. I'm just gonna call him Simar. Just mentioning that I had good points that they are getting back into the physical game of SCP for the first time in something like 30 years. ACTA and Star Armada are easier and quicker to play, pick up and play games for sure. And I agree that, and actually I need to read up on the Star Armada, especially the Unity Edition, which, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, for those of, I know you weren't here, Barry, but other people might have listened to it.
Yeah.
And that is that... the great thing about Star Armada Unity is there's one set of rules. The bad thing about Star Armada Unity is that there is one set of rules. Because of, they combine the rules, but the problem with combined rules, yeah, and they say, take option A or option B. And that defines how you play. You can basically be using the same set of rules, but you're playing it differently. I'm not so sure that's a good thing. When it comes to the ships being mm-hmm. the same, you know, the because most of the differences are basically movement. How is movement handled? Is it more of free movement kind of thing where You move a ship, I move a ship. You move a ship, I move a ship. Or is it more like pre-plotted movement? Where, okay, you plot all your ships, I'll plot all my ships, and then we'll reveal our moves. Which, personally, mm-hmm. I like that one, because that is the one. That's the set of rules that I got introduced to which I found fascinating. And I love the idea of pre-plotted movement like that. Of course, also, the first time I played Star Armada on the Klingon Armada rules at Origins, which is so many years ago now, is that it wasn't the movement rules are definitely different between Star Armada and SFB in that it was mainly vector based. You know, you could do a constant acceleration. So you could use use 6 points to accelerate you 6 more points, and then 6 more points. But there's one big issue with that, which is in the rules. I'm sure that Daniel Cast designed it this way to make sure people didn't do this, which is the constant acceleration, which is the faster you are, it's harder to turn. So if you move too fast, you basically had to spend one or maybe two turns slowing down enough so you actually could change the facing of the ship.
Well, that depends on, is this warp powered or is this Newtonian motion?
Well, the rules
were, in other words, that the ship matter. In other words, if you have a ship that, like, remember the old Asteroids game? That was a true vector based, where the direction you were thrusting in determined how you were adding to your speed.
Right.
You could rotate your ship, and your angle that your ship was pointed at had absolutely nothing to do with what direction you were moving.
Right, right. Star Armada wasn't that far to Newtonian, but had the idea of acceleration and how much movement, how many movement points you had for that ship. So it wasn't SFB, warp movement, where, based on your speed, it took you a while to turn. This one was that whatever speed you are, given that speed, that's how much movement points are required to turn the ship one hex. And with obviously because of its...
Now, when you turn the ship, when you rotated the ship, did it change your direction of movement?
Yes.
Or did it just change your facing?
It changed your direction of movement. That's why it took so long to turn.
Right, right.
Because the faster you were going forward, the more effort, the more movement cost, basically, it took you to turn your ship.
Yeah.
And this is adaptation of SFB into the Star Armada rules.
Right. I think Ken Burnside came up with turn mode. How did he put? What was the terminology he used? Was movement mode 1, 2, and 3?
Right.
Which was how many of Newton's laws of motion are you, or Galileo's laws of motion are you using?
Right.
Movement mode 1 was basically say, okay, this is the direction I'm going, and you could turn and then move. And you only had so many rotations or turns in a ship in a turn, but you could rotate. And then let's say I put 6 points of power into motion, I go 6. And if I don't put power into motion, I stop.
Right.
So it's turn and move. That was movement mode one. Movement mode two said, okay, well, really when I put power into movement, it is acceleration. And if I turn, I travel in the direction that I'm facing. But every time I turn, I lose speed.
Right.
So if I'm going at high speed, I can still turn, but I lose a lot of speed in the turn. Movement mode three is I apply thrust, and that gives me an acceleration, and my direction of facing has nothing to do with the direction that I'm traveling.
Right.
Other than the direction of facing is a direction that I can apply thrust to change the motion or add a vector to my motion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of that go too fast, but even so, it was that particular system did not have an impulse based system, so it was plot motion, move, fire. And if the weapons were fairly short ranged, you could go right past somebody, even if you guessed right what they were doing, you'd go right past them and be right out of your weapons range or arcs.
Right.
Before you had a chance to fire.
And yeah, well, that's...
I understand.
Yeah, that's why I love, you know, pre-plotted movement. The whole idea of that you are, as a ship's captain, that you're able to respond that quickly to actions of the movement of your opponent is kind of crazy. Now, yes, you can prepare.
You mean free movement, not pre,
right?
Not pre-plotted,
right? And that was the original.
Yeah.
Explanation in SFB about the requiring the use of pre-plotted movement. And that, to me, that makes sense.
Right.
That the cap, you know, you can prep for things. That's what energy allocations are for. Is that you're prepping for,
yeah,
you know, for firing your photons. Yes, you can say fire photons, boom. But
right.
Adjusting, right. Oh, he moved just slightly to the left. Oh, I need to move slightly to the right. You know.
Right. Then FedCom took a lot of the pre-plotting out of the energy allocation. Because even in Starfleet battles, even with free movement, still you've got
yeah, but here's the one thing, Barry.
Energy allocation is completely...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's the one thing about FedCom is that, in my mind, they missed it with FedCom. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately,
okay,
the way they missed it was to change it so that it was what I think FedCom really should have been, will require changing of things drastically. And that is, the one thing they wanted to do was make it a fast-playing game. Now,
right.
the reason why they missed it, in my mind, is that as soon as you added the requirement of tracking the status of your weapon, i.e., you have to charge, you have to put 2 points of power first turn, 2 points of power second turn, 3 points of power for the third turn. Now you got your plasma torpedo ready.
Yeah.
That's when they lost it. Right then.
Well, The plasma was always going to be a longer
Right, but
arming length
okay, let's
than
go
other weapons.
photons.
So that's
Photons, same thing.
well, photon.
Yeah,
Well, it still takes an extra turn, though.
the point was that it was supposed to simplify. Basically, just as long as you have the energy to fire your weapon when it's time to fire, boom, done. Now,
Yeah.
the possibility of doing something along the range of what Ken Burnside did, where the whole idea of action points to a certain degree, but okay, you want to simulate the same thing? Okay, maybe lower the cost overall for the amount of power, but require that you delay. You fire your photon. Well, I'm sorry, you can't fire it for another 2 turns. You have to have a cool down period of sort.
Right.
But at that point,
Yeah.
you're just tracking, was it used or not used? You're not tracking, okay, I've got it overloaded or not overloaded or whatever. You don't track that. You just have the power available and you fire. That to me, that's where they missed. Which was that's why
I am.
it was not is more in my mind more of a SFB light. So it didn't really do what I think the original goal was, at least my understanding, which is that to speed up the game. I'm not so sure it really speeds up the game.
What they should have done was a Starfleet Battles Light that was faster playing. You're right. They did not do that. It is not faster playing. In fact, in some ways, it can be slower playing. But they did that, and they did not get rid of the impulses.
Oh, understood. And that.
Yeah. In any case, it's getting late. I'm falling asleep here.
Okay, understood. Well, Barry, you have a good night. You have a good Christmas, because we won't have another
Yep.
podcast until next year.
Ah,
Well,
okay.
if a podcast night falls on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve.
There's a possibility I may be able to head up your way for Saturday or Sunday for brass, if that's a possibility.
That might be possible. I have to, which Saturday or Sunday?
This one,
Oh,
this coming weekend.
I have to check
That
things.
work for you?
I have to check.
Yeah.
I'm not sure at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, give me a ring.
We'll do. We'll do. In the meantime, you have a good night.
Okay. Good night.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, Samar. I agree. I love pre-plotted movement. As we both agree, we like the unity rules. There's not. You say there's not enough variety among the factions for SFU version to make them feel different. I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about, because usually the differences in factions is not the way the ships move, but more of the weapons that are in that universe. Because of my understanding with Star Armada, and I would hope this is the case. If it isn't, because Lord knows that makes no sense, is that you have a consistent way of movement and doing things between the different ships that are from the different factions that you create in Star Armada. Because one thing about Star Armada is that it allows you to actually create your own ships, some along the lines of like Starfire and that kind of thing. But movement and weapons interactions, those I would think have to be consistent to a certain fashion, the way you view the universe, that science fiction universe, and how that would work. Now, okay. Tamar is mentioning that he thinks the factions feel more different in SFB than they do in Star Armada, and that is possible. I'd actually I'd have to relook at those to really get a good feel for that and good judgment for that overall. But I think what I would love to try one of these days, when it comes to playing FedCom, mini pre-plotted. And that is, have it so that you, because each impulse is four subpulses. So in the case of, if you're converting between FedCom and SFB, each impulse and each mega impulse is equivalent to four impulses in SFB. Now, if you instead of doing what you do now, which is the whole SFB thing when it comes to who has, the whole initiative thing based on speed, which I love that part of SFB. I think it's really a good thing about that step, but that's the thing that's derived off of free movement. Now, if you did pre-plotted movement for those simple single impulses, just four, you have to predict it. Now, you can still have everything that is available in FedCom, cancel movement, increase speed, things like that. You can still do that. That'd be fine. But it'd be all pretty pre-plotted. All four impulses, sub-pulses would be pre-plotted. And then from there, then you just play them out. That's always been one of those ideas that I've had for play by email. The only one is that play by email on FedCom, so that you wouldn't need a moderator, but there's still certain things that you need a moderation tool per se. And that is, there are certain things that need to be done secretly and simultaneously. The big issue for not having moderatorless is that you don't have someone barking at you, get in your orders. You just have your friend that you're playing with, and you might forget. And the only reason, that's when a moderator comes into play. It's like, hey, you're supposed to have it in 2 days ago. Where is it? Things like that. And has a way of keeping the game moving. And that's one of the things. Yeah. But, so. I think doing that for FedCom, going back to playing, in life, real life, I think that'd be interesting. I think it's doable. I think, because I would love to have someone to take me up on it. That is the idea of doing small pre-plotted sections of SFB. Maybe it will require me actually modifying the SFB Online client to allow it so that people would do it. That might be what would be required. Which would be interesting. I can do it. I could probably do it. Be interesting to try. Yep. Yeah, I know. I know. We got sidetracked. on the main show topic to grow the SMB community. Samara was saying we need to figure out how to engage younger gamers with software jobs. I have a couple of friends who have lured in to start playing SMB because of the layers of SMB rules appear to them engineering mindset. And Samar, that, my dear friend, is the reason why I got interested in SMB to begin with, was because I looked at the rules. I started reading the rules. Yeah, there's a lot of rules, but the whole idea of all the rules brought it to life. You know, being that engineer really brought it to life. Now, I'll go through this real quick because I don't have as much time as I really wanted to have to talk about building the SMB community. There's a few things that we're doing right when it comes to building the community on Facebook, in that, you know, we're having the group, we invite people in, we answer people's questions, but I have not been keeping an eye on that group, on the SFB or SFB Online group, as much as I probably should, to gauge where we are in the engagement of people and engagement of the community, to build up that community and to be able to invite new people into the community and help them. Now, the one thing that when it comes to SMB Online, it seems like a lot of cases people are waiting for me to do everything. I'm not sure whether it's because I give people the perception that I want to do everything, or that people just assume because they have to pay, therefore it's a commercial product, that I will be doing everything. I don't think that if you look at other communities based off a game, you know, an online game, like, you know, there's all kinds of games, that all of the videos out there are created by the people who produced the game. Do they? No. Especially with their playthroughs and things like that. Currently, I think I'm the only person actually generating screen recordings of my games and posting them. I've done this in the past where I've actually recorded other people's games and I've posted those things. And for a while there was a point in time where actually I was doing my best to post, you know, whenever I got online, I would find a game, I'd watch for a while, do some screenshots, post it up on Facebook, try to get some engagement going that way. Which I think is a great idea. But one thing I talked to my daughter about, which was, you know, I said, you know, I wanted to rack her brain because she is a YouTube person. She doesn't have a channel or anything like that, but she does a lot of video editing. And I asked her, okay, you know, the issue is obviously that SMB takes a long time to play. And I think it'd be quite boring to have people watch an SMB game because of how long it takes. It might take two, it might take 6 hours. And it's not exactly the most scintillating game in the world. It's like taking a chess game and drawing it out to 2 hours for a single game. If you know chess, it's very interesting. If you don't know it, you're not interested. So, you know, I mentioned to her how what I do for mine is that I will replay a game at like four times the speed, the 4x, because of the biggest issue that I have is that a lot of that time is waiting for the other player to do his, or waiting for me to decide what I'm going to be doing. So given that, I asked, okay, what's better, to speed it up or something else? And what she said is she told me that the best thing to do when it comes to YouTube videos in that case is basically do a playthrough video like Markiplier or there's many other YouTube video people out there. The Markiplier just comes to my mind because she watches Markiplier all the time, which is to take the game and spend the time to split it and divide it up into those action points. And my guess is that for those games, you'll say, okay, to hit the high, basically, it's a highlights reel kind of thing, when it comes to like NFL football, where you have these highlight reels. And basically do the same thing for an SFB game, create a highlight reel. Now, obviously, the highlight reel is going to be a heck of a lot shorter than actual play. The question in that case comes into being is that, is there something that we can do to speed up play? Yep, exactly. And Samara, here's the question. If we do that, will that actually give people interest into the game? Because here's the one thing that concerns me at the moment. Here's the one thing that definitely concerns me about doing that. That people will see these wonderfully, tightly edited, cut out all the boring stuff, parts of the game. And they'll see, the action, the important points where this is where he came in behind him, and then, six impulses later, he gets his shot and blasts it, and then you see, all the rolling of the dice, you see the damage that's taken to the ship, and then you go forward. Now, maybe I should try doing that with one of my games. The tough part about doing tightly edited stuff like that, it takes a long time to do. To get the idea of the flow of the game and where are the important pieces that still tell the story of the game. And I only have so much time in a week. This isn't my full-time gig. I have a day job. My day job starts at like 6:30 in the morning and ends at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So, then I have some time after that. And depending upon what day it is, I have more time or less time. Because also I have to run Starfleet Warlord, I have to correct any things, I have to run the business, make sure that I actually pay Steve Cole his licensing fees and so forth, so that I gotta keep track of that. So there, I can easily imagine hours where I'm doing nothing but SFB business. But anyway, and I know doing a tightly edited video, it'd take me like 3 to 4 hours. It would be my guess, but that is what it is. The tough part is going to be constantly posting up videos of the games, because that means I have to be there, or someone else has to be recording it. I can't be there for every single game, and I only have so many hours in the day, unless I want to say, okay, I'm not going to do my podcast anymore. I'm not going to be doing a lot of other activities. I'm just going to focus on building up the SFB community, which will pay me nothing. So at least with SFB Online and Starfleet Warlord, it pays me something at the very least to support what I'm doing with those. So I'll see what I can do. Anyhow, I got to wrap this up because as it is, I know it's going to take like an hour for this to be all cut up, diced up, trimmed up, and posted up. So thank you, Samara, for joining us. And with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.